Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is November 18th, 2019, and before introducing today's guest, I want to encourage listeners to go to econtalk.org, econtalk.org, and in the upper left-hand corner, you'll find the link to our annual survey where you can vote for your favorite episodes of the year, tell us about yourself and your listening experience. And now for today's guest. My guest is journalist and author Adam Minter. His latest book, and the subject of today's episode, is Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Adam, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Your book's about the market for the extra stuff that we come to realize that we don't want, we can't store, we don't use, we might be able to sell, we feel guilty about having, and so on. And you open talking about people who make a living clearing out houses of old folks and dead folks, sadly, and talk about that business and what they do with the stuff.
Sure. Well, I think there's probably always been businesses like that, at least since the Industrial Revolution. But it's in the last 30 years in particular that it's become kind of professionalized. It really started becoming professionalized in the U.S. in the 1980s when we first saw downsizing, a mass downsizing into retirement homes. And there was a need for people to come in and basically help seniors decide what to get rid of. That's a hard process because the real lesson in downsizing for retirement, for example, is your kids don't want your stuff. And I spend a lot of time on cleanouts, and the advice that everybody who does this in North America says, you know, you're going to tell me I'm saving this for the kids, and I'm going to tell you the kids don't want it. And so they are not just people who come and clean out the house, but the best ones really serve in kind of a counseling role. And it's a business that has also expanded, not just in North America, you know, as the baby boomers decline into retirement, but it's also very big in Japan. And I spent quite a bit of time with the Japanese cleanout industry, and it's driven by slightly different demographic circumstances. As we all know, you know, in East Asia, they're facing demographic crises, South Korea and Japan in particular. And so as Japan ages, like the United States, there's a question of where this stuff goes, but they have the added burden of there's less people who want it. And so the cleanout professionals in Japan are dealing with that sort of double whammy. It's great for business, but they've had to more aggressively develop a sort of reverse supply chains into export markets. And so it's much more of a global business, which surprised me than what one would tend to think when it's just a matter of, say, cleaning out grandma's back bedroom.
So it's like they come to your house, they help you go through, they help you, might be the children after parents are gone. Helping go through the house. What do they do with the stuff?
So it all depends. So there's a few different kinds of these. You know, you may have in the United States the 1-800 junk trucks where they'll just take a quick look at it, and if there's something that doesn't strike them right away as valuable, they're off to the dump. Then there are the businesses like Gentle Transitions, which I describe in the Twin Cities, which might be the very first incorporated clean out business in the United States. Hard to figure that out for sure, but they were very early into it. And they will, first of all, help you pack up the stuff that you're going to take to your retirement community, your smaller home. And they actually told me, I was really surprised to say, we've moved people 5-6 times, you know, between different retirement communities. And it's amazing how they accumulate more stuff that then needs to be downsized again. So they'll do that kind of thing. And at the end of it, they may call somebody like a 1-800 junk truck. But sort of the new generation is a company such like Empty the Nest, which is a Minneapolis-based company, where they will help you downsize it. They will make sure that the stuff gets to where you want it to go, but then they are going to actively look to market that stuff into the secondhand market. And so Empty the Nest has its own thrift store in Minneapolis. So they'll clean things out, and what they think is marketable, they'll take to their own thrift store. What they think may be marketable by somebody else, like the Salvation Army, which has, say, a lower price point, they'll bring it there. They'll take some of it to recyclers. And this is really important to boomers in particular, who, at least the cleanout professionals tell me, and from what I witness, they want to know where things go. You know, there's a real question of reverse provenance, if you will.
So, what do they charge?
It all depends. You know, everyone has a different price point. So,
roughly, give me a range.
You know, I think you're talking for some of the better ones, anywhere from the range of $2,000 to $3,000, plus the cost of the truck, the logistics of moving stuff.
And if they sell the stuff, do you get any of that money?
Depends who it is. Like Empty the Nest, actually, their fee is very much based upon what they think they can recoup. So, you know, if you have enough good stuff, and most people don't, your costs may end up being close to zero.
So I'm thinking about my own life, which your book made me, of course, contemplate. And I want to let listeners know we're going to talk a little bit about this. Then we're going to talk about goodwill, which just turns out to be fascinating. And then something even more fascinating, which doesn't seem fascinating at all, which is rags. But we want to start with this clean out stuff problem. In my case, you know, I have thousands of books. Mm-hmm. And of my children, some of them love to read. Some of them like to read. And I always assumed they would love to have my books. I'm not so sure. Some of them will, maybe, but they're not going to have room at many points in their life for the number of books I have, and I'm going to have to probably get rid of them. My father has many more books than I do, has thousands of books, and most of us don't want them. And it breaks my heart, actually. It's incredibly sad because he did collect them for himself, but part of it was this idea that he'd pass them on. And then we have my dining room table, which is this beautiful oak antique table my wife and I bought 30 years ago that we cherish. Is it possible our kids aren't going to want that table? And your book suggests they might not.
Yeah, that oak table in particular is...
There's tons of them, you suggested, right, laying around.
Yeah, if you go to thrift stores, particularly in the Midwest, where that kind of furniture was extremely popular for many, many years, they are overflowing with oak tables that nobody wants. And it comes down to a matter of taste. People want, you know, a cleaner look right now, is something sort of influenced by mid-century modernism. Also, just the way homes are designed with the big windows now, giant oak tables don't go well, and people move around more than they used to. And with home ownership rates declining a little bit, and you think you're going to be renting for a while, you don't want to keep moving those heavy oak tables. So it's really put this downward pressure on the price of this, you know, what they call in the trade, the brown furniture.
The brown furniture. Yeah, we love oak. And we lived in St. Louis when we first got married, and there was a huge amount of available oak there, and some very talented refinishers, and they made it beautiful. One of the other things you, of course, talk about along the way is storage places. So one of the temptations you have is, well, okay, I don't have room for everything. I'll just put it in a storage place. And you have this statistic in here. There are 54,000 mini storage facilities. I don't know why they call it mini. I guess because it's not a warehouse.
Right.
Mini storage facilities. Like it ranges anywhere from a cubicle to a garage or a largest garage, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's this metastasizing industry in the United States that's really out there responding to the fact that people are, you know, buying themselves out of their homes. I mean, one of the most fascinating statistics that I came across while doing this book was the amount of garage space in Los Angeles that can no longer be used for cars, residential garage space. This was, you know, a statistic from the 90s, but it was well over 75%. So, but people don't want to get rid of the stuff. You know, they're very attached to their stuff. So what do? They go and get a mini storage unit. And in some municipalities in the United States, you know, the cost of those mini storage units, the rent is higher per square foot than many residential areas. So we're actually spending more storing our stuff than we are storing ourselves.
And it was, it's troubling. As you get older, you start to think about these questions. And I like the idea of not liking my stuff, but that's only an idea. I really like my stuff. I like my cutting board, and I like my dishes, and I like my artwork, and I like my framed photographs, and I like that furniture. I've got two 6-foot high bookcases that were old school, meaning from a high school probably in the 30s or 40s. With the paned windows, glass doors. I love those. I'd be sad to see them go. And when I'm out of town in the summer, I love they don't have anything. I'm free. But I like that it's back home. And it's just a weird thing to confront the fact how much of your identity and your sense of self is the stuff you've accumulated.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, and as sort of traditional social bonds have broken down in Western societies in particular, we build up our identities, you know, the sense of ourselves on the basis of what we buy, this accumulation of objects. You know, it's
pitiful, Adam, but it's true.
It's really true, you know, and, you know, in a sense, nobody knows it better in a way than, you know, Google and Facebook, because they're constantly taking data on, you know, what we like to acquire, what brands we like, and then they try and sell it back to us. So in that sense, you know, they have that complete picture of us based upon our brands and our relationships. But it's why it becomes, one reason why I believe it becomes so hard to let go, because in letting go of our stuff, we are breaking apart our identity. And I've been in cleanouts where people do that, and it's painful to watch somebody let go of, say, their wedding china.
Yeah. And of course, there's our clothing, which we're going to spend some time on. I like to think I'm not into clothes. And I think anyone who's hung out with me for any length of time would say that's a true statement based on the way I dress. And yet, the number of shoes that I have, many of which I don't ever wear, the number of shirts that I own that I don't ever wear, the number of t-shirts that I just love that I don't ever wear, and I like having them. And occasionally I go through that drawer and I think, yeah, I'll just keep it. And it's just, it's hard.
It is, and I face the same issue. I mean, I have t-shirts that I never wear, and, you know, my wife will sometimes go through, you know, the linens and say, do you really need this t-shirt? And then I remember, you know, where it was given to me, or I just can't let go of it. And it's an emotional reaction. It's certainly not a rational reaction, because all it does is take up space. But it's a memory, and it's a piece of who I was at some particular point in time, and you just don't like to let go of that stuff.
So there was a moment in my life when I actually thought I'd get organized. It didn't last very long. But I hired someone to help me clean up my office at work. And one of her themes was all that junk in your closet, all that junk here, all the books you don't read. And footnote, I have to say, most of the books that I don't read, I've eventually come to read or was glad to have them to share with my children, even though I didn't read them for 20 or 30 years. So books I feel are in a different category. And they do decorate a room. I'm a big fan of books. But Her theme was, and I love this, was you could let someone else enjoy them. And that really did work for me for a while. And I think it's a great idea. It is hard to give it up. It's hard to walk away from some of your emotional connected stuff. At the same time, the idea that it has a home somewhere else, and that's important, and you write about that in the book quite a few times. You want it to have a home somewhere. You can give it up if you know that someone else at least is going to enjoy it.
Right. And it's almost primal. I mean, that was...
I think it is primal.
And it was so interesting to me, both in Japan watching cleanouts and in the United States, you know, very different cultures. And yet in both cases, I would see cleanout professionals say to the people, you know, their clients saying, I can take this somewhere. Don't worry. You know, and you'd see sort of the tension come out of the shoulders and they'd feel better and they could let go of it. You know, there was just that primal need to feel like the stuff that was valuable to me, it's going to be valuable to somebody else. Now, you know, there were times I know that was a white lie, you know, and they just need to move it on. You know, they've been hired by children to move things on, and they have to market the moving, if you will, yeah, to the people they're doing it with. But that reassurance is so important.
Yeah, it's crazy. Let's talk about Goodwill, which I confess I didn't think much about until I read your book. We have a Goodwill about, I don't know, 2-3 miles from us, and I do go there often. I wish I could go there more often to dump stuff and give stuff away. But I will show up there with a garbage bag or two of clothes that my wife and I aren't wearing anymore. There's a bookstore nearby that collects books for a library to raise money for a library that they sell the used books. And I dump off books there every once in a while that I feel I can live without. It's hard, but I can do it. And I give them away. I feel good when I drive off. And I've never thought much about what happens next. I do have some, unease would be too strong a word, curiosity about the things I've put in the bag. There are things I would not put in the bag, right, that I would say, oh, this is too beat up. I'll throw this away. But in general, what I put in the bag is a mixture of worn clothing and other things. But you went deeply into what happens to that stuff. So talk about that.
Sure. Well, it was one of the reasons why I wanted to do the book. I always think of Goodwill as kind of the Kleenex of the thrift industry. You know, it's I'm taking things to Goodwill and people take it to Salvation Army. So I want to know what happened beyond the donation door. What I found was an incredibly sophisticated business. It's a nonprofit and they use the money they earn to do some really great things with job training in their community. But to generate that money, they have to be incredibly sophisticated about how they sort these things and how they price these things. And these things are everything. There was this great moment when I was reporting the book, and one of the retail managers at the Goodwill Southern Arizona, he said to me, he said, it's a little bit like if you're working at a Walmart and you get a call and your inventory truck's coming in, and by the way, we don't know what's in it, and it's going to be totally different than everything that was in it the last time, and it's up to you to sort it and to price it, and oh, by the way, make a profit. And yet, that's what Goodwill does. It's far more sophisticated than a Walmart. And, you know, some of the most enjoyable reporting I've ever done is just to sit with the clothing sorters and talk to them about why are you putting that piece, that garment in the $3.99 bin? Why are you putting that one in the $7.99 bin? Why is this one going to Goodwill's boutique? And they explain to you on the basis of feeling the fabric, you know, on the basis of the brand. And their goal is to make money from it. It's completely profit-oriented. They want to maximize the values of these donations, which was very reassuring to me. Because, you know, I think we all wondered, I wondered before this book, are they really being careful with it? But they have every incentive to be careful with it because otherwise they have to pay to dispose of it.
Yeah, in my mind, they just throw most of it out. But some of it, of course, does get thrown out. But as you point out, they're very sophisticated in how they price it. So give me a feel for that feel that sorter was telling you. What kind of issues are determining where stuff goes?
Sure. Well, if we just talk about clothing, you know, they'll have on the wall, at least this is at the Goodwill Southern Arizona store where I spent time, they'll have a list of, you know, dozens of brands with numbers on them, what the value is. And some of these brands, especially if they're coming from mass retailers like a Walmart or a Target, there just isn't a secondhand market for them, and they are not going to put them on the floor.
Is that because they could buy the new one across the street cheaply, or is it also because they're not made to last very long? I assume it's both.
Both. You know, that's fascinating. The Goodwill sorters will tell you over the last 3 years, they've really seen a decline in the quality of the clothes. And that's within specific brands. And they're absolutely sure of it. And I believe them. I mean, they're handling these things on a minute-by-minute basis. But the other problem is that Goodwill is very much in competition with the new goods sector. The store in Southern Arizona that I spent time with off of Houghton Road is across the street from a Walmart. And the manager of that store, of the Goodwill store, is very conscious at all times of what Walmart is charging for new goods. So even though, you know, in her opinion, the Walmart goods may not be as good a quality as some of the stuff that's hitting the floor in the Goodwill, you give most people the choice. They want that shiny new thing, even though they could be buying a more durable product that's probably going to last longer. So she has to be conscious of that, and her prices have to move down to account for that that Walmart price, because given the choice between the two at the same price point, people are going to opt for that new Walmart garment.
Now, one of the issues of your book, we'll come back to it maybe at the end, is the fact that most things in our world don't last very long,
right.
Clothing in particular. And I'm less critical of that than I would say you are in the book. I think most people like it for the same reason. I'll give you a version of the conversation I had with my son, who is a minimalist by name.
Okay.
I think I'm not sure what the counterpart is to being a minimalist by name. You know, if you're not careful, minimalism is just an excuse to buy different stuff to carry your minimalist goods with and in. But he's something of a minimalist. Let's just leave it at that. And he was talking about how Apple AirPods wear out after about 2 years. The battery can't be saved. It'll just not be rechargeable after about 2 years. And he was saying how horrible that is. And I thought, well, it's a little horrible. But it's also the fact that probably in 2 years, there's going to be a much better model coming along. And I would probably like to upgrade. So I'm probably going to want a cheaper version now that I know won't last very long. You might say, well, $150 isn't cheap. But I want a cheaper version now that won't last very long because I want to upgrade. And I think that's true of fashion a lot. We're very rich. It's a sign of our wealth that much of the stuff that we have wears out. So it's not just that we'd like to get a good price. Mm-hmm. We'd like to pay a good price because we want to reserve the right to get a better item in the near future.
Well, I totally agree with you. And I think what's been really remarkable over the last you know, 40 years in particular is not just, you know, our society, say the United States has grown incredibly affluent over that period. But at the same time, China in particular, but East Asia in general, has become incredibly proficient to manufacturing to certain price points. Right. You know, and I've had the experience. I reported in China and Chinese factories for many years. And it was one of the most amazing things I ever encountered was going into an apparel factory. And I actually heard the apparel manager, the factory manager say, well, you like this design that was being made for an expensive brand in the US. Well, we can make this at your price point, same garment, you know, no problem. And I encountered that a few years later with suitcase designs, very nice suitcase for a well-known brand. And I was with a purchasing, someone from an American purchasing firm, and they said, we like that, but we can't pay that price for it. And they said, no problem. We can make a few changes here and there. Won't be as durable, but we will be able to manufacture to that price point. So I think those are the two phenomena together have combined, you know, for better or for worse, to create this confluence of stuff that's piling up in our homes.
And by the way, you said in passing that we've become so affluent over the last 40 years. I'm in a long-running argument with most of my profession because I think we have become quite affluent over the last 40 years, whereas it's become, I was going to say fashionable, it's not nice. It's become, many economists today believe that only a small portion of the economy has done well. As I was reading your book, I was wondering if there's some data one could get at about waste, about garbage, about throwing stuff out that shows how widespread that affluence is, the magnitude of these people throwing away and recycling things is so large, it's kind of hard to argue that it's just a small slice of the American economy.
Right. Well, you know, I've been covering the waste and recycling trade for, you know, a good chunk of my professional life. And there's a few things that are axiomatic in waste and recycling. And that is the more affluent a society is, the more it throws away. And I mean, the data is really clear on that. And it's really no accident that, for example, China's waste and recycling numbers have just skyrocketed in recent years. And they're not to the per capita point of the United States yet, but they are sheer volume the world's largest generator of waste right now, and that isn't just people at the very top in Beijing. I mean, it's people across the income spectrum.
Yeah, and I assume you don't, of course, just use per capita because it could be that the top 10% or 1% is doing all the throwing out, but I think it's a little wider than that. One of the shocking numbers in your book is the revenue of goodwill, which, if I remember, is a little over. I'll let listeners think about what that might be, but the number is over $5 billion.
Correct.
Of a $17 billion industry of thrift. That's a stunning number.
It absolutely is, you know, and they are, you know, they're just a part of it, you know, and the best we can calculate is in terms of the volume of stuff, waste stuff moving around the United States, they're only about 3% of it. But, you know, in terms of the revenues, you know, it's somewhere around 1/3. So it's an extraordinarily large business. Now, there are dozens of what are called goodwill federations across the United States. So there is an international goodwill headquarters that's actually located just outside of D.C., but the federations operate independently, and yet they're all part of this bigger goodwill hole.
But is that $5 billion nationally in America or worldwide?
Worldwide. Yeah, but I mean, the majority of which comes in North America. Yeah.
So the part that I also did, so that's revenue.
Mm-hmm.
They have costs. They have employees who do the sorting. They have employees who run the cash registers and so on. Do we know what their profit is? Roughly?
I don't.
Okay.
I wish I did.
But they make a reasonably large amount of money. And the part that I never thought about was they actually do something with it. So talk about that.
Yeah. Well, goodwill goes back 100 years. And from the beginning, they have been what they call mission-oriented. And their mission is job training. And they are interested from the beginning in basically making people more productive members of society through employment. And that's what they do. So in Southern Arizona, where I spent a lot of time, they spend huge amounts of money on the most difficult to employ cases. So like people coming out of the juvenile justice system. They will not only help them get the GEDs, they will even subsidize their salaries and first employers. They will have classes in soft skills for them. It's really extraordinary. One thing that's kind of a misconception out there about goodwill is they do not hire these people who they help. You know, and they were very clear that's a conflict of interest for them. You know, the mission-oriented work really is about pushing people out into the community where they can work and be gainful members of society.
So who's in that mission? The people who are sorting they're not volunteers. They're employees, I assume.
Right.
Who cares?
Well,
who's caring about this?
Sure. There's dozens of, just talking about the goodwill of Southern Arizona, where I spent the time, it's dozens of employees who are devoted 100% of their time to working with, you know, oftentimes these juveniles on a full-time basis. And they open up community centers, and there's people there to counsel these kids, to help them study. So it's really a big part of the infrastructure. The goodwill of Southern Arizona actually has co-CEOs. One is devoted to the retail operations. The other is devoted to the social service mission.
So cool. One of the things that surprised me, didn't know, is that they sometimes sell new stuff, not just donated used stuff.
Absolutely. And it's a marketing device. So as Kathy Zack, who's the manager of the store on Houghton Avenue across from a Walmart, said to me, she says, look, people are going to come in here buying clothes for their kids. They're also going to want to buy toothbrushes. They're going to want to buy toothpaste and soap. Why shouldn't we sell that stuff too? Why shouldn't we be a destination for all of those things? It's not something Goodwill likes to talk about a lot because their brand kind of is a secondhand. But if you think of them as competing with the new economy, it's a really smart and savvy move.
Let's talk about the trend in junk and stuff. Junk's not the right word, but stuff. So you talk about the fact that it's growing, that we have a lot more stuff. Now, part of it is our wealth. Part of it's our population. Part of it is the cultural zeitgeist of minimalism and decluttering and the Marie Kondo phenomenon. So talk about Marie Kondo and whether you think those things are anything more than just little blips in the landscape or whether if they're important.
Well, one of the interesting things I found in reporting this book is that Marie Kondo in Japan, which is where she's from, is nothing new or particularly special. This sort of home thrift movement is almost dates back to, you know, the Taylorite movements of the 20s in Japan, which revolutionized manufacturing. And some of this stuff was applied to the household. It really emerged as more of a household movement in the 80s and particularly in the 90s when the economy stagnated and there was sort of this crisis of confidence in Japan and people started dematerializing a little bit. But Marie Kondo emerges from that. But one of the interesting...
Talk about who she is, because might be two or three people listening who don't know.
Sure. Well, she's an international phenomenon and celebrity, and she has written a book that became a television series called The Japanese Art of Decluttering, and the idea is you need to spark joy in yourself by letting go of your things. And her method, the KonMari method, is you pick up something, look at it. If it sparks joy in your heart or wherever it would be, you keep it. If it doesn't, it goes out the door. It's sometimes misinterpreted as an environmental movement. And actually, to Marie Kondo's credit, because she could certainly really ride that environmental side of it, she's been quite clear that no, it's not. It's about personal consumption and just sort of clearing your headspace. But it's much bigger in the United States, Marie Kondo herself, than it is in Japan.
So do you think it's an important phenomenon, or is it just a cultural shtick? I mean... that idea, it's a variant on the one we mentioned before that, you know, would someone enjoy this more maybe than you are? You're not getting much joy from it.
Yeah.
It's a very hard standard, by the way. Very few of my physical items spark joy. She's easy to make a little bit of fun of. But do you think it's had any imaginably measurable impact on the river of stuff that's getting given away and reused?
So, you know, when the television show first hit really big in January, she was all over every news outlet, and I actually called up some thrift stores and asked, are you seeing a spike in stuff? And they said, yes, we are, because of that. But it's dropped off.
Yeah.
You know, there was this moment. It's hard to pinpoint, but in Japan, she is part of an important movement there. But she's not the most prominent one. And there's been a lot of thought along her lines and people decluttering in Japan for a long time. And it was really after the Fukushima disaster that if you talk to people in the secondhand industry, things really changed. And there was more selling of stuff into the secondhand market, and that's persisted. And even Book Off, which is a corporation, for-profit corporation, you know, they have around 800 outlets in Japan. I talked to, you know, managers there, and they said, we felt something change in the overall secondhand market after that. It wasn't just the surge of stuff, but the nature of the stuff coming in changed a little bit, too. Stuff that people would have held on to longer.
So we're talking about our affluence adding to this river of stuff. But there's another side to this that's a little quirkier, which we haven't talked about, which is hoarding and collecting.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people who don't just buy lots of stuff because they like to shop. They like to have, like a former guest on the program, lots of sneakers or lots of figurines. And you talk in the book about one of the challenges emotionally, especially, we're not about giving up just everyday items, but people's collection of X, which used to be worthwhile, now is totally valueless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the Hummel figurines. Yeah. I mean, if you go into an antique store anywhere in the United States and you ask them about their Hummel figures, which are these, they started making them, I think, believe in the 1950s in Germany, and they became a really hot collector's item, really back in the 70s. Now, the price has completely collapsed because the generation that loved them isn't there anymore. One of the more interesting comments that was given to me in the course of reporting this book, and it's in the book, was made by Jill Freeman, who I consider her sort of a master cleanout specialist in Minneapolis. I mean, she is the counselor, to the hardest cases, and she's very good at valuing the stuff. And she said to me in a coffee shop, she said, hoarding is a spectrum disorder, and it's just a question of where we all land on it. And that really gave me pause, and it sent me back to watch some episodes of Hoarders, and I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder, but I think she has a point. And I think there is something very human in wanting to acquire, to order, and to collect. And I think there are plenty of anthropologists who would probably agree with me on that. You know, I don't know where that comes from, but I was very careful not to sort of go too far into the hoarders, but not to separate everybody from it, because I think we're all to some degree there.
Yeah, it's a form of security.
Yeah.
And more, I think a better way to say it, an issue I'm increasingly interested in psychologically and hope to have some episodes on down the road is our need for control.
Yeah.
So hoarding is a really primitive way of exerting control over my environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a source of comfort. I can look at that collection and feel good about it. Of course, some people, it's a constant taunt. It's like you don't have the next one. You should have more, and so on. But I do think it's a psychologically adaptive activity.
Definitely. There's also a social side to all of this.
Yeah.
I heard from many cleanout specialists, Home Shopping Network is a real problem. And they hate it because
why?
Because you have lonely people who call it up, and that becomes their outlet. You know, they call up and they talk to the operators and they order things. And I was given many stories of walking into houses with hundreds of Home Shopping Network boxes just piled up. And that was the social interaction. The flip side of that is, Goodwill, many people at Donation Doors told me, the workers at Donation Doors told me, that they will have regulars come in every day, older people bringing in just little things because it's their excuse to interact with somebody. And so the consumption and reverse consumption becomes a very important social activity.
Yeah, I thought you were going to talk about flea markets and running into the people who are like you are competitors, but also you share this obsession potentially with mm-hmm. them. And there's a certain, I think, tribal social aspect to it.
Absolutely. Well, shopping is the social activity. Now, I mean, one of the biggest, fastest growing phenomenon in online shopping is combining social media with shopping. And you see Facebook doing it with its marketplace. It's even bigger in Asia. WeChat, the all powerful Chinese chat program, actively integrates commerce into the chat interactions so that your friends, you see what they're buying and you can buy it. They can recommend things. So the shopping experience is very much wrapped up in your social network.
Mao is probably turning in his grave, but he's a man who deserves to turn in his grave, in my
mm-hmm.
View. Perhaps that's unfair, but let's turn to my favorite part of the book, which is rags. I hadn't thought much about rags. It is a chance for me to use a Yiddish word, which I think has never been mentioned on this program, which is shmata. A shmata is Yiddish for rag, and of course, shmata means more than just a literal rag. It really means the industry of textiles and clothing. And when someone would say typically in America in the 30s or 40s, oh, he's in the shmata business, it means he was involved in some aspect of either literally rags, but also textiles. it's also a derogatory word for a piece of clothing that's not up to one's standards. Would you like to buy this? No, that's a schmata. So now, linguistic episode over. What is amazing to me is that there is an enormous industry around rags. Wouldn't have guessed it. You know, we have rags in our house. They're T-shirts that wore out finally that we tore. We didn't tear them. We probably used a pair of scissors and cut them into two or three pieces. And that's our – those are – we have some rags. People buy them. People make them. Talk about it.
Yeah. It's – I mean, it's basically the industrialization of what you do at home, what we do at home, what my mother did at home and grandmother, which is the clothes get old and you cut them up and you make them into rags. But it, the industrialization is very interesting. It dates back 200 years. But for right now, it basically accounts for one-third of the clothing sent for recycling in the United States goes into rag-making enterprises. And what they do is they buy the rags and it's
– Where are they getting those?
So it could be – Sure, yeah. Sure. It could be from Goodwills. These are clothes that maybe Goodwill judges can't be sold. It could be from hospitals. It could be from hotels, the sheets, the linens, because these also go through rag-making enterprises. Any business that's generating large amounts of fabric, new or old, that should go to waste, it's going to end up more likely than not at some point with the rag maker. At the rag maker, they're cut up to certain specs. The company that I write about in secondhand called Star Wipers in Newark, Ohio, outside of Columbus, they're very proud that they do 10 rags to the pound and say other companies do 6 rags to the pound. Our rags are better. Who buys them?
You'd think their rags are smaller, but I think it's the accuracy with which they cut, right?
Well, and smaller is Todd Wilson. It was very interesting. I spent a lot of time with him, seeing what a good rag should look like. And he pulled out rags from other companies and he kept talking about angel wings. So somebody would take a T-shirt, slice it down the middle, and throw it into a pack as a rag. And he says, we don't do that. We don't do that. That's how Todd will talk to you. He says, we cut a proper rag, you know, that you can use to wipe off your dipstick, to wipe down a table, you know, not an angel wing, like a T-shirt that's just been split in half.
But before you go on, and because I want to get in a little more detail in that process, because you describe it really beautifully. It's hard to say that, but it's true. It's beautifully described. Rags. Who needs rags? Who would buy? I mean, I've never bought a rag.
Right. Well, if you owned an auto garage, you know, and you needed a rag to wipe off a dipstick or to wipe off a leak on the floor. If you operate an oil pipeline and you have leaks and you have people doing maintenance and you need to wipe those up, you need rags. If you are a hotel and you have a housekeeping staff and that housekeeping staff is wiping down furniture and wiping down the bathrooms, they need rags. If you have a bar and you're drying cups and glasses, you need rags. I mean, the sky is the limit. Painters, believe it or not, somebody who paints houses for a living or paints hotel rooms for a living, you need rags to wipe brushes, to wipe corners. You know, and you would never think, it never had occurred to me to this day that it's such an extraordinarily large business and there is such huge demand for these kinds of materials, this kind of product, but it's out there. And in total for the economy, it can swallow up one-third of that used clothing.
And it's, if I think the right metric is billions of rags.
Billions, easily.
Billions, which is mind-blowing. After I read your book, I went on to Amazon. You can buy rags there. I don't know where they come from. They're made of different qualities. You can have 100% cotton rags, or at least that's the theory. We'll talk about whether that's true or not. Mm-hmm. You can have microfiber rags. But the interesting thing about your buddy Todd Wilson and that business is that you say they need rags. Now, there is competition. Obviously, Star Wipers has other rag makers, but rags themselves compete with
paper towels, right, for example, and synthetic rags, you know, and more and more. And the marketing is really interesting. I mentioned in the book, in a footnote, Kimberly-Clark actually actively advertises its new synthetic wipes as being sort of cleaner and more respectable than a used rag. And they have this one ad where they show, you know, a very respectable-looking guy who's you know, obviously represents synthetic rags next to a sort of a sweaty mechanic, all greasy, and he's the secondhand rag, you know, and it's an amazing advertisement that tells us something, you know, really interesting about the economy of cleaning, which most people never think about.
But a third of that clothing is going to get turned into these rags. So this is sweatshirts, T-shirts, flannel shirts. I don't know what else.
Flannel sheets. Yeah, flannel sheets.
And the first thing, let's talk about the process in a little more detail. So first thing that happens, first let's talk about the different kinds and the different qualities that people care about. Mm-hmm. So some people, a rag is not a rag.
No, it's not. It's, as Todd will tell you, it's a tool. And you need a tool to match the need of the industry. And so really the classic example is you would not want to give a polyester rag to an oil and gas company to wipe down a pipeline because polyester can accumulate static electricity. And that's a really bad thing to have around an oil and gas pipeline. It might explode. So they're not going to buy a polyester rag. They're not going to buy a rag that's a polyester cotton blend rag, which is a real problem. They want a straight cotton rag. And so to supply that straight, guarantee that straight cotton rag, Todd actually, his company actually, you know, goes from farm to rag cutter so they can guarantee that it's 100% cotton and they grew the cotton.
But right, they make new rags. Those are not recycled.
Right. And they call them the STB, the Simply the Best, for people who really want that 100% cotton rag. But so many other industries are okay having that rag that might be a poly cotton blend of some kind there, or, you know, is probably not a straight polyester rag because it's not going to absorb very much. But they want something that absorbs. And that's the other interesting thing about this industry that just threw me when I was with Todd. You know, most people who aren't in the rag industry will think of, you know, a good quality piece of clothing as a new piece of clothing. It's completely the reverse in rags. They want that t-shirt that's been washed and washed and washed because it's more absorbent. And so one of the things that Star Wipers does, so it can prepare these garments, is they will actually buy, you know, cuttings and newly manufactured clothes that have been rejected, for example, from manufacturers. So I believe it's every two...
Irregulars or whatever, I assume, yeah.
Every couple weeks, they'll get a shipment coming in from Bangladesh, manufacturers there. But it's new cloth. So they have an amazing laundry that looks like a giant caterpillar there in which they wash this stuff to simulate it, having been through a washer many times. And the reason they do that is it makes it softer and more absorbent. So there's a manufacturing process to this. It's not just a matter of cutting up the rag.
So I assume everything is going to get washed at some amount.
Sure.
Right. So in very hot water?
Kind of
gross, right?
Yeah. But even this is new fabric coming in from Bangladesh.
But some of it's not, a lot of it's not new
right.
in this American factory, right?
Sure. You think about, Todd's company does a lot of business with healthcare textiles. You know, so that stuff isn't even washed at Todd's place. That's going to be washed before it ever hits his facility. He doesn't want something that's been in a hospital coming into a factory like that. So that's a real issue, sure.
So let's just take a t-shirt that a bad rag cutter would cut in half down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wiper's not going to do that. How are they going to do it? They've got some kind of automated, and it's not done with scissors.
Well, no, it's people are doing that. It's a very interesting machine where you sort of have this waist level blade. It's a spinning razor inside of a guard, and the workers will then take the garment and slide it through that, and it makes a very clean cut. And the Star Wipers cut, and I probably cannot do it justice, especially the way Todd does it, but
on a podcast, especially. But we do have there's an article on Bloomberg that you wrote that has some. Video of that. We'll put that up. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, you start cutting under the armpit. And one of the goals you have is if there's anything hard, anything sharp, a zipper, you know, a sparkly print or something like that, that's got to be cut away. And if it can't be cut away, then it's actually bound for the landfill. The other interesting thing, and I didn't describe it in the book or in Bloomberg, is there's also a lot of clothing goes through a magnet system to make sure that there's no metal attached to that garment. So there's a really interesting magnet system and the garments go through, and if a magnet detects something, you know, this escape hatch opens
whoop,
and it drops.
Yeah.
Because you don't want, you know, a sharp metal something on that, that sweatshirt you're going to use.
At the car wash.
Yeah, exactly.
Car comes off the assembly line or, right, it's a lot
disaster.
Of polishing.
Yeah,
disaster. So it gets cut up, and now what?
And from there, it's packaged. And in Todd's company, Star Wipers, does not sell directly to consumers. They sell to distributors who are asking for various kinds of rags for various uses. So, you know, the painters might be okay with a rag that has more polyester in it. You know, it just all depends what people are requesting. You know, sweatshirts are in very high demand because it's a very absorbent material. So car washes like those. It just depends who his customers are, but they do the sort to make sure that it goes to the right kind of customer.
And do they give them names or grades other than STB, Simply the Best, which is a name I want to kind of hold on to for a while? I like that name, STB.
Sure.
Simply the Best, that's the top. But do they have, like, not quite the best and then, like, eh? And then they have, or how do they describe?
Sure. You might see, you know, white sweatshirt, you know, would be a way of describing. It's basically described as what it is, you know, colored t-shirt, you know, and that's very important, color versus white. You know, if you're going to be wiping down a table, you probably don't want a colored t-shirt to do it. You know, you don't want something that's going to bleed. You know, you probably want white. And so in this business, white obviously is going to fetch a premium, especially white sweatshirt. It's going to fetch a premium over, say, colored t-shirt. And it's, again, it's a tool.
But if I'm that business and I've got a truck pulls up, well, I don't even know what pulls up. You tell me. So a bunch of stuff pulls up. I don't know what it's in. It's in a bale, in a box, it's thousands of t-shirts, thousands of sweatshirts. They're not all the same. It's a big
right, and they
glob.
And they right, and they sort it, you know, and they have very. I mean, that's again, it's very similar to secondhand. And one of the amazing things about the secondhand industry as a whole is the level of sophistication and knowledge, you know, inherent in sorting our used stuff that we may not think of anything. We just throw it into a bag and take it to Goodwill. But you have people in these factories, you know, employees who, you know, who have been doing this for years and have this incredible, canny sense, you know, on site, on feel, to be able to sort, you know, different grades of t-shirts even into the correct pile so that they can be sold to the right people.
But if I'm that individual in this facility doing the cutting, I'm going to be cutting maybe a t-shirt and then a sweatshirt. Mm-hmm. Then how does it get organized after that to create a bale of, say, white t-shirts? I'm not going to just be cutting white t-shirts,
sure.
Right?
Well, a lot of it is sorted ahead of time.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's what you're getting at. A lot of it is sort of ahead of time. And the people who are selling to Star Wipers have an incentive to sort that stuff ahead of time. You know, if they send Star Wipers a big bale of white t-shirt, they're going to get paid a lot more than if it's white mixed with red, you know, and yellow and green, because then Todd is going to have to devote labor to sorting that out. It's going to hit his costs. So a lot of the sorting, I see where you're getting at now, is actually done even before it hits the factory.
And if I remember correctly, there's some unease about the deterioration of quality in the raw materials that they're working with. It's part of the reason they're growing their own. And
right.
Do you say it's totally integrated? They've got a cotton? They have their own cotton?
Yeah, they grow their own cotton, and they have their own knitting mill, and I believe they cut at the knitting mill as well. I think they cut in Newark. I think I saw some cut.
But he
in
was
Newark.
Complaining, I think, that the quality's off, that 100% cotton isn't 100%
right.
Cotton anymore. They mix in some polyester to keep the cost
And that's
down.
Why they're doing it, because, for decades, you know, as long as we've been making clothes, you know, if somebody said 100% cotton, it meant 100% cotton. But in the 80s, it started to change a little bit as the margins on manufacturing textiles got tighter and tighter and tighter. People started integrating more polyester into the cotton blends. And you are supposed to, you know, by law, actually accurately label this thing, you know, this garment and say what's in it. In reality, a lot of people, especially outside of the U.S., are not labeling correctly. And we know that because Todd knows that, because he has to be very careful. He's not selling, as we said earlier, polyester blend t-shirts to oil and gas pipelines.
So his customers care more than the average t-shirt wearer, obviously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a question of safety. And so that's why they had to start offering new rags, new cotton rags. And it's an interesting example of sort of how deterioration in quality can, at least in this sector, drive the manufacture of new.
And the number I have here is that they sell, it's hard to believe, 15 million pounds of rags per year.
Yeah.
Are they the largest in the United States, do we think?
They are probably the largest cutting on its own in the United States. There's also a huge offshore trade and manufacture of rags, which makes a lot of sense because it's a very labor-intensive industry, and that's the kind of business you would expect to move offshore. So you have quite a few rag companies in the United States that actually import their rags and then wholesale them. But Todd is cutting his own.
The other part of this business that surprised you and surprised me is that, in my mind, Americans buy lots of t-shirts that say maybe a university name on them or a rock band or whatever it is, or just a plain t-shirt, and then they get tired of them, and they get sent overseas to a poor country, and they're sold there secondhand. Then I can imagine they wear out, and they come back here, and we make rags out of them. But it's a lot more complicated than that. There's a lot more stuff going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the supply chain or the reverse supply chain is incredibly complex. I went to India to get some sense of how it's happening. In fact, the world's biggest sorting center is actually a free port in India called Kandla, which is on the west coast of India. And India doesn't allow the import of secondhand clothes, but it allows—
Legally.
Legally, because there's lots of secondhand clothes. Clothes going all over India, which we see. But Kandla is allowed to import clothes, process them. That could mean, you know, sort them for reuse as clothes in Africa. Or you actually have large cutting operations there now. And so the clothes go out from Kandla into Africa, into Southeast Asia. And there's a few of these hubs globally. There's one in Mississauga, Ontario. Another one is actually Kuala Lumpur, Port Klang. And they are sort of the global hubs of this trade. And they both export, but also import, and they are sources of rags, say, for Todd. And Todd has actually gone to Kandla and trained people in Kandla how to cut for Star Wipers cuts the way he wants them cut. Not the angel cut, as I call it. I don't think Todd would call it that, but we'll call it the angel cut, but the way he wants it cut.
Yeah, the angel cut is STW, simply the worst.
Simply the worst, yeah.
Yeah. But the in the ban, a lot of countries have bans on importing and use of secondhand clothing because they want to protect their domestic textile manufacturers and domestic clothing manufacturers. Of course, that's a mixed bag for the people who need to wear cheaper, would like to maybe wear cheaper clothes.
Absolutely. And we see that in Rwanda right now where they've effectively banned it. They've raised the taxes substantially so on secondhand clothes moving in with the idea that that will encourage manufacture of new clothes. And you have several Chinese companies that have moved into Rwanda, not Rwandan companies, but Chinese companies are making new. But meanwhile, the predictable has happened and there is a vast trade of smuggling secondhand into Rwanda right now because people can't afford the new clothes.
And smuggling is costly, so that means you have to compensate the smugglers for their time, like any other business, even though it's under the table. Now we're going to turn to one of my favorite things in the book, which I don't think you made enough out of, Adam. I think it's really one of the incredibly cool things, which is the recycling of sweaters. So one of the aspects of the underlying phenomena in your book is that a lot of the wealthier nations live in colder climates. The things they wear to keep them warm when it's cold are not of much interest to people who live in warmer climates. So there's a question of what to do with sweaters.
Right.
They don't have the market that a t-shirt might have in the secondhand market. What happens to them? And we're going to get to why I love this in a second.
Sure. Well, a very small number flow into Eastern Europe, but the vast majority of wool sweaters are going to flow to a place called Panipat, which is a town about an hour and a half drive north of Delhi in India. And Panipat, really since about the mid-1970s, has been the heart of the wool recycling trade in the world. And this trade dates back to the earliest days of the Industrial Revolution, when people were trying to figure out what to do with wool after it couldn't be worn anymore.
It's easy. You just take an end and just start pulling until you get a really long piece of yarn and you're done. You got a new piece of yarn. But that isn't what they do.
It isn't what they do.
That's what I'd do.
Right. What they do is they take these sweaters and other wool garments. It's not just sweaters, but wool in general. And it's essentially chopped up. They have these big machines that rip these garments apart into their individual fibers and then re-roll them into a fabric called shoddy.
That's my favorite thing. Shoddy. It's not called shoddy because they're shoddy. I think stuff is shoddy because it's this.
It's
is that
this.
Correct? It's the
this.
Origin of the word shoddy.
And it goes back to the early 19th century. It was invented in the early 19th century in the UK. And for years, the UK was the heart of the shoddy trade. Then it moved to Prato, Italy. And then it moved eventually to Panipat. And Panipat became the heart of this trade. And what's fascinating about what Panipat did is it cornered the market in what's called relief blankets. So relief blankets are, most people don't know what they are. I didn't know what they were until I got to Panipat. Relief blankets are, if you see the Red Cross go in for some kind of relief operation, a hurricane or an earthquake, and they're bringing blankets, those blankets, until quite recently, were made of shoddy, which is this fabric that's made in Panipat. It's a very low...
Recycled wool.
It's rough. It doesn't feel great on the skin. It's not very nice colors. And it tends to smell musty. But it's cheap and it will keep you warm. So it's great for relief blankets. And in India, it was also sold retail. It is considered the poor man's blanket. That's what it was in India.
Now, is it something like pressed board? Like the taking shavings of wood and mashing them. I don't know if that's the right word. Pressed board, pressed wood.
I know what you mean.
Sort of the second lower quality wood. It's not really wood. It's been fused essentially. Mm-hmm. So the verb you use in the book for shoddy is it gets shredded. Mm-hmm. So you take a bunch of sweaters, you shred them. So now you got what, little pieces of fabric?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think
that's what do you do with it? Do you understand the process?
Mean, it's you turn it into a low quality yarn. So the thread count is very low compared to, say, a new wool yarn. But it's the only way to do it. You've got to tear the stuff apart to make it new again. And so that's one of the reasons it's shoddy. If something is shoddy, it's low quality. And the thread count in this yarn is very, very low as compared to, say, a new wool yarn. It's just not very good.
So now you talk about the fact that the shoddy relief blankets, do you have any idea of how many get produced a year?
Millions at the peak of the trade.
Right. And is it only used for relief?
Well, like I said,
for
it's also the
crises?
It's also a poor man's blanket, as they call
okay.
it. And there was some export to South America and some to Africa, but not in any significance.
So their new competitor, though, is a synthetic.
Yeah, it's polar fleece.
Yeah.
And polar fleece.
What is polar fleece?
It's polyester, essentially.
It's not a sheep?
It comes from
a cold climate? Oh.
Yeah, polar fleece is a great, great branding,
it's
unbelievable. But yeah, polar fleece. So polar fleece has been around for a few decades. But like many things, Chinese factories really mastered the way to make it cheap. And pretty soon they realized that they could almost beat Panipat for a relief blanket. They could make a polar fleece relief blanket almost at the price point that Panipat was making its shoddy blanket. But they could do a couple things better. One, they could make more quickly because it's coming off basically a factory line. They just come flying off the line. If somebody in Geneva calls up China and says, I need 500,000 polar fleece blankets for this disaster, they can do it really quickly. But if you talk to the folks in Panipat, they say, that's a real risk to us. It'll take us months to do, and we could build up the inventory, but what if they change, the specs on the blanket? So as a result, over the last few years, China has really cornered the market on relief blankets, and they've become polar fleece.
Incredible. Let's talk about the policy implications of this. One of the things you don't talk about that's always in the back of my mind is the cost of landfill, which obviously we can price it in various ways to encourage recycling, reuse. We've talked a lot in this program about recycling and composting. And I think we're at a point in America right now. I like to use this example. And when I'm out in Palo Alto in the summer, my garbage can's about the size of a small backpack.
Right.
Basically, you can throw out a couple of tissues, but and maybe a package or something, but otherwise you've got to recycle it or you have to compost it, which I find vile. And I've confessed on the program, I've started to do I've been a little easier about composting recently, but it's still kind of, there are things I don't like about it and I think there's some costs to it that are often ignored. But the impression I have is that the recycling market's collapsed and that a lot of what is recycled today in America, which is often mandatory by law, by the legislation, is getting thrown away anyway. Is that true?
There are a lot of recycling programs that have failed over the last couple of years. But surprisingly, many also have remained resilient. And part of the reason they've been resilient is they've raised the fees associated with them. And so they've been able to subsidize the trips to the landfill or subsidize trips shipping to places where perhaps the margins wouldn't have been as good, but they can swallow some of the costs of doing that. And things will get recycled. You know, there's no question that recycling of certain products, especially plastics, have declined precipitously in recent years. And a lot of that's moving to incinerators.
Do you know why?
Because the market's dried up. Not dried up. I mean, one, China decided that it was no longer going to import most recyclables, and they were the number one customer globally for it. And, you know, there were a lot of reasons China did that. I think the number one reason they did it is they wanted to develop their own domestic recycling industry, and American plastics in particular were considered better quality, and they simply couldn't compete with it. So when you lose that, when you lose your biggest customer, suddenly it's supply and demand. You've got this massive supply, the price collapses, and there's nowhere for it to go. It's a funny situation in the global recycling industry right now because I grew up in the recycling industry. And when the price of a commodity...
Meaning
my family was in the scrap metal industry. And, you know, in the past, if the price of copper went down or the price of aluminum went down, you would adjust. Maybe you would buy a little less, you know, you wouldn't hold on, but you would operate a good business. But the problem we have now is that these municipal recycling programs aren't really economically based. They're environmentally based. And so even as the biggest customer sort of stopped buying, you still had campaigns in American cities saying, let's boost our recycling rate. And it's completely backwards. And, you know, for me, as somebody who grew up in the industry, I think the proper way to look at recycling is an economic activity. And it can be a very profitable one and a very beneficial one. But if you just start looking at it as an environmental activity, that's when you get into problems and you find municipalities, you know, scrambling to figure out what to do with this stuff.
Yeah, the way I would phrase it is if you see it as a religious activity, which
sure,
something that, you know, is morally exemplary, you're going to have costs that you might ignore if you're not careful.
Sure.
But one of the things you talk about, which I think is interesting, although I don't agree with it, and you don't agree with it either, but you talk about it, at least I don't think you agree with it, is that this idea of obsolescence, the idea that a lot of the stuff that we consume, which is a bad word because it implies it gets used up. It doesn't. It's the stuff we buy mm-hmm. and then that lingers in our houses, that a lot of it is made to wear out quickly. And mm-hmm. you could make an argument that that has costs of different kinds. You could argue, I'm not going to do that too vehemently, but you could argue that landfill is underpriced. And so that there's a distortion in the market of people have an incentive to throw stuff out sooner than they otherwise would. And maybe it would be a good idea to have legislation that would require manufacturers to make stuff that lasted longer mm-hmm. rather than that was shoddy, say.
Right.
Lower quality. So, you raise that possibility, then you pretty much reject it. What's why?
Well, I mean, France has a law prohibiting planned obsolescence, which is a very ambitious law when you think about it.
Yeah.
And they don't. They've, so far as I know, they've never had the guts to actually prosecute a company for doing it. And it would be, I think, judicial suicide to do it. How do you even define the crime? But you know, their imperative is just what you said. I don't think outlawing planned obsolescence is a good idea. I think we are a society that still depends upon innovation. And if you want innovation, then you can't start constraining people, you know, putting up parameters on how long a product should last, you know, what a product should be. Let people innovate in the way they will. I do think there is something to be said for a certain level of transparency and manufacturers revealing to consumers, you know, how long they expect their products to last. That doesn't need to be burdensome. That doesn't even need to be a law. I just think that there's certain industries that collectively would benefit if they got together and said, let's come up with some standards so that we can tell consumers, you know, the plan is to support this product with software for 5 years, or the motors in our washing machines are designed to last 10 years. And to give consumers, I'm a big believer in consumer choice. I think that's good for everybody in making good choices. If you give that kind of transparency, that might actually improve durability because consumer surveys show, at least in theory, consumers want to buy longer lasting products, longer lasting washing machines. So make it easier for them to do it.
Yeah, I think it's really important to distinguish between a washing machine, which is a real pain in the neck to replace
yep.
and shop for, and it's not really, I don't get any, there's not much romance the way there is, say, about shopping for a new car
mm-hmm.
Or other, even a new phone or stereo or anything, whatever stereo is, it's the wrong phrase because we don't have stereos anymore. Just listen to music on our phones. But I do think there's an interesting issue here. And you have a sentence that would only bother me. I think probably the only person who was bothered by it in your book. You say, in 1924, the world's largest lighting manufacturers formed a cartel that agreed to reduce the lifespan of light bulbs as a means of boosting sales. Now, I used to teach microeconomics every year, taught it for 30 years. There's a classic fallacy that students come in with when not just students, but people have in general, which is manufacturers want stuff to wear out so they can sell you more. It's the same idea that the toothpaste, the reason you can't get the last little bit out is because that way you'll buy another tube. That is, in my experience of life, is not how people compete, which means you have to have an explanation of why the toothpaste is hard to get out of the last part. And I have a theory about that. Won't go into it now. Challenge listeners to think about what that might be. But I do think it's a really interesting issue in that, in my worldview in general, competition prevents manufacturers from exploiting people by making crummy stuff when people would prefer a longer-lasting item. And light bulbs, you know, the classic example, there's a number of Hollywood examples. The best one is The Man in the White Suit, Alec Guinness. Alec Guinness plays a chemist who develops a material that lasts forever. He's hounded and destroyed, or they try to destroy him, because if it lasted forever, then we'd never sell another suit. No, you'd sell that first suit for an enormous amount of money, though. So that would be a plus, not a minus. And then, of course, you could still sell some more suits because the cut would change and the fashion would change. And it's just a misunderstanding, I think, of how business works and how profits work and how competition works. But in my lifetime, of course, one more example, stocking manufacturers could make stockings that don't run, but that they wouldn't sell anymore. So they've all decided not to. But of course, the real reason is that stockings that don't run are really thick and uncomfortable. Women don't like them. There are such stockings. Right. People hate them. But my presumption, when I look at light bulbs, you know, just get longer and longer. Now they last forever, which is beautiful, because changing a light bulb is annoying. There's no romance like, oh, I want to make sure I get the latest one. I just want one that makes light. There are some new variations in how hot they are and how much energy they use, which is not irrelevant. But in general, manufacturers compete by how long their light bulbs last, not how quickly they burn out. So if there was a cartel in 1924, I guess it didn't last long.
It didn't last very long. No, that's correct. Right. You know, one of the interesting phenomena in recent years is, I think there is now, as the price of smartphones goes up, there is an incentive for the manufacturers to actually ensure that these things last longer. And we're starting to see that, because in interesting ways, I think it's very fascinating that Apple, for example, is starting to act like a car dealership. They will take trade-ins on your phone, they will refurbish them, and then it's hard to find on their site, but they have their certified refurbished store, and you can buy, you know, a used Apple iPhone at a discount, and it's sort of the car dealership model. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting about that is that means that people are starting to think in terms of resale value on their smartphones.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, and it makes sense, because they're quite expensive.
Yeah.
You know?
And they don't really wear out. The battery does wear out, but the rest of the components are pretty immortal.
Yeah.
And as you point out at one point in the book, most of them aren't recyclable. A lot of the pieces inside are not recyclable.
Right.
It's hard to – it's expensive to get them out.
Yeah, it just isn't there.
Yeah. So let's close. I'm going to read a paragraph from the book. We talked about this before, but I'm going to let you muse on this as we let you take it home. You say, though I've never been much of a shopper, the experience of reporting this book, days spent in thrift shops and attending home cleanouts, made me reassess my own consumption and hoarding. The things that I value, I quickly realized, generally aren't valuable to anyone but me. Once I had that understanding, I started letting go and curtailing what I was buying in the first place.
That's precisely what happened. It was a journey for both my wife and I. You know, I'd come home with stories of warehouses in Japan filled with used books. And, you know, that Book Off is the company. And this was a real turning point for us. I'm an author. And being in a warehouse full of books that the company is assessing very quickly and doing a triage on, with the majority triaged into baskets headed for the paper mill, was quite shocking. And it really upsetting in a certain way. And we both sort of stopped buying books at that point. My wife did something funny. She became, a bit of a boutique used book dealer. And I described that a little bit in the book. She realized she didn't need so many books. She tried giving them away. And she found she actually got rid of more of them if she sold them than if she gave them away. But for both of us, it really made us think about what the long-term implications are for acquiring so much stuff, not so much from an environmental perspective, but just from a social perspective. We have a son, you know, do we really want to leave all, you know, a big full house of stuff for him to figure out how to clean out? Not really. And so it changed us.
My guest today has been Adam Minter. His book is Secondhand. Adam, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thank you so much.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.